reader is predisposed by the comment to expect a vision of the word of Yahweh. Samuel keeps hearing a voice calling his name while he is trying to sleep. He assumes it's the voice of the priest Eli and goes to the elderly man, but it was not Eli who spoke. After hearing the voice a third time, Eli realizes that it is Yahweh who is calling and instructs Samuel how to respond if it happens again. Samuel goes back to bed. The narrative resumes in verse 10. Then Yahweh came and stood there and called out as before, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, because your servant is listening." The description has Yahweh standing before Samuel. That he is clearly visible is made known by the ending of the chapter. And Samuel grew up, and Yahweh was with him. He did not allow any of his prophecies to go unfulfilled. All Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, realized that Samuel was faithful as a prophet to Yahweh. And Yahweh appeared again in Shiloh, for Yahweh revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh through the word of Yahweh. 1 Samuel 3:19-21. I was amazed the first time I saw this passage for what it was really saying. Yahweh appeared to Samuel with regularity in verse 21. The first verse of the chapter makes a clear association between the word of the Lord and a visionary experience, not a mere auditory event. The idea of the visible word, the visible Yahweh, in human form, is nailed down by the standing language. Some passages go beyond presenting Yahweh in visible human form. Genesis 18 is perhaps the most startling example, where Yahweh is not only visible, but embodied. And Yahweh appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, and he was sitting in the doorway of the tent at the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, three men were standing near him. And he saw them, and ran from the doorway of the tent to meet them. And he bowed down to the ground, and he said, "My lord, if I have found favor in your eyes, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest under the tree. And let me bring a piece of bread, then refresh yourselves. Afterward you can pass on once you have passed by with your servant." Then they said, "Do so as you have said." Genesis 18:1-5. That one of these three men is Yahweh is evident from the first verse. That the appearance of Yahweh and his two companions is physical is telegraphed by the request to wash their feet and partake in a meal, which they subsequently do. The narrator and the reader, of course, know that one of the men is Yahweh, but does Abraham? That he does is made clear from the conversation he has with the embodied Yahweh. After their meal, the other two men, whom we discover are angels in Genesis 19, leave to go to Sodom. Once Abraham discerns that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is imminent, he objects out of concern for his nephew Lot, a resident of Sodom. Addressing the Yahweh figure, Abraham says in verse 25, "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to kill the righteous with the wicked, that the righteous would be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do justice?" Abraham knows the person before him is the judge of all the earth, since he addresses his plea directly. He addresses the figure as "you" twice before the rhetorical question that invokes the divine title. How did Abraham know that the figure before whom he stood was Yahweh? The chronology of his encounters in Genesis would tell us that he had heard Yahweh's voice before. This oral recognition is present in other passages involving Abraham that we'll see in a moment. But I also think Abraham visually recognized his visitor from those previous encounters. Note: many scholars resist saying Abraham knew that he was speaking to Yahweh, because in verses 3 and 27-32, he addresses the figure as Adonai, not with a divine name, Yahweh. Abraham did address Yahweh by name earlier. Sarai refers to God by this name as well. Readers of Genesis 18, of course, know immediately that the figure who appears to Abraham at Mamre is Yahweh. This problem is misleading. That Abraham knew the divine name in the biblical text as we have it is no requirement that he use it in every exchange. The term Adonai was a culturally proper term of reception of a guest or person due respect. That Abraham understood who his guest was is suggested by Genesis 18:25. When Abraham learns the fate that awaits Sodom and Gomorrah, the reader is not told how he learns that, he says to Yahweh, "Far be it from you, will not the judge of all the earth do justice?" Note that the statement correlates the judge of all the earth with you. While it is possible from the language to say that Abraham could have viewed the three men as equals and the judge of all the earth as a fourth person removed from the scene, that option is not compelling, nor is it consistent with the earlier encounters. There is no textual reason that forbids the notion that Abraham recognized the lead figure as Yahweh. End note. One final example from the Old Testament of an embodied Yahweh who is the Word is far less known, but no less dramatic. In Jeremiah 1, the prophet is called to service. He writes that the word of Yahweh came to him and said, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you came out from the womb, I consecrated you. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." Jeremiah identifies this word as Yahweh himself when he replies, "Ah, Lord Yahweh, I do not know how to speak, for I am a youth." Yahweh, the Word, tells him to not be afraid, and then something shocking happens. Jeremiah writes in verse 9 that Yahweh, the Word, stretched out his hand, and he touched my mouth. Sounds don't reach out and touch people. This is the language of a physical, embodied presence. Whispers of a Godhead. These passages raise three questions. First, it's one thing to see that Yahweh appears in human form even to the point of embodiment, but what is the logic of this language? In other words, why do this? Second, how is it that if this word was Yahweh, and the word was visible and embodied, Jews of Jesus' day could tolerate the notion that Jesus was Yahweh incarnate on earth while Yahweh was still in heaven? After all, Jesus prayed to the Father and spoke of the Father, Yahweh of Israel, in the third person. How could a Jew accommodate this binitarian idea that, essentially, there were two Yahwehs, one invisible and in heaven, the other on earth in visible form? Note: the subject matter of the next two chapters does not argue for an Israelite Godhead on the basis of Eliasm. The use of the third person by God Yahweh to God Yahweh. While this phenomenon, evidenced in several passages of the Old Testament, was part of the two powers in heaven discussion within Judaism, I will follow different, more substantive trajectories. End note. Third, does this help or harm the New Testament articulation of a Trinity? Was the Trinity a new idea? The answers to these questions are all found in the Old Testament. What we've begun to uncover in this chapter are whispers of the idea of a Godhead in the Old Testament, the Bible of Judaism. Those whispers will get much louder as we continue. Chapter 17. Yahweh Visible and Invisible. At the close of the last chapter, I noted that the word of Yahweh, being a visible appearance of God as a man, raised certain questions. One of those was how a first century Jew would have parsed the idea of Jesus being the Word made flesh. True, there was Old Testament precedent for Yahweh being visible and embodied. That phenomenon would have helped a Jew accept at least the idea that God could show up in human form. But it was more complicated than that. When Jesus referred to God in the third person or prayed to God, what then? Would a Jew have been able to wrap her mind around that one? How could God be here, visibly and physically, and still be in heaven? Today, this apparent conundrum is what keeps many Jews from embracing Christianity. It feels like polytheism to them. Given this context, It's amazing how first-century Jews could embrace Jesus as Yahweh and not feel as if they were betraying the God of Israel. In fact, these same Jews were willing to die instead of worshiping the gods of the Greeks and the Romans. We could also ask certain questions about readers of the Old Testament prior to the time of Jesus. When ancient Israelites read the passages we looked at in the last chapter, did they imagine that Yahweh was localized in only one place? Had he left heaven? Was he no longer omnipresent? The startling reality is that long before Jesus and the New Testament, careful readers of the Old Testament would not have been troubled by the notion of, essentially, two Yahwehs, one invisible and in heaven, the other manifest on earth in a variety of visible forms, including that of a man. In some instances, the two Yahweh figures are found together in the same scene. In this and the chapter that follows, we'll see that the Word was just one expression of a visible Yahweh in human form. Note: the Jewish community that inherited the Old Testament was well aware of this. For centuries, Judaism felt no discomfort with the notion of two Yahweh figures. The idea was referred to as the two powers in heaven and was endorsed within Judaism until the 2nd century AD. It is important to note that the two powers were both holy. This is not dualism, where two equal deities exist, one good, the other evil. The major work on Judaism's two powers teaching was published originally in 1971 by the late Alan Segal. Segal was Jewish, and his career focused on Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism. His work documents how the two powers idea became a heresy in Judaism in the 2nd century AD. It was recently reprinted. The Old Testament roots of the two powers doctrine were one of the major focus points of my doctoral dissertation. The logic of the two Yahweh figures in the Old Testament reflects an Israelite adaptation of the Canaanite structuring of the top tier of the Canaanite divine council. End note. The concept of a Godhead in the Old Testament has many facets and layers. After the birth of his promised son Isaac, Abraham's spiritual journey includes a divine figure that is integral to Israelite Godhead thinking, the angel of Yahweh. Although the most telling passages that show this angel as a visible embodiment of the very presence of Yahweh occur later than the time of Abraham, there are early hints of his nature during the lifetimes of Abraham and his sons. The Angel of Yahweh. The heart-wrenching story of Genesis 22, where Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his covenant son Isaac, is our next stop. It's something of a transitional passage. We've seen that Abraham has had several encounters with Yahweh. The expression used to convey the visible, physical nature of those encounters has, to this point, been the Word of Yahweh. Genesis 22 marks a shift in the language for a visible Yahweh figure to the Angel of Yahweh. Although the Angel of Yahweh appears earlier than Genesis 22, this particular appearance begins to blur the identities of Yahweh and his angel. Genesis 22:1-9 relates how Abraham has taken Isaac at the bizarre command of Yahweh to Mount Moriah to offer his son as a burnt offering. We pick up the story in verse 10. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. And the angel of Yahweh called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not stretch out your hand against the boy. Do not do anything to him. For now I know that you are one who fears God, since you have not withheld your son, your only child, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a ram was caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it as a burnt offering in place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, Yahweh will provide. For which reason it is said today, On the mountain of Yahweh it shall be provided. And the angel of Yahweh called to Abraham a second time from heaven, and he said, I swear by myself, declares Yahweh, that because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only child, that I will certainly bless you and greatly multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and as the sand that is by the shore of the sea. And your offspring will take possession of the gate of his enemies. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through your offspring, because you have listened to my voice. Genesis 22:10-18. The first thing to notice is that when the angel of Yahweh speaks to Abraham, Abraham recognizes the voice. He does not ask the identity of the speaker, as though the voice is unfamiliar. He does not fear that he is hearkening to the voice of another god. The reader, however, knows that the source is not Yahweh per se, but the angel of Yahweh. The word translated angel here is the Hebrew word melach, which simply means messenger. The next observation is very important. The angel speaks to Abraham in verse 11, and so is distinguished from God. But immediately after doing so, he commends Abraham for not withholding Isaac from me. There is a switch to the first person, which, given that God himself had told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, seems to require seeing Yahweh as the speaker. Many scholars would say that this is due to the angel being Yahweh's mouthpiece, standing in Yahweh's place, as it were. But that idea is conveyed only later in the passage, when, in verse 16, the angel prefaces his words with, declares Yahweh. In verse 11, there is no such clarification. The wording of the text blurs the distinction between Yahweh and the angel by swapping the angel into the role of the person who initially demanded the sacrifice as a test, Yahweh himself. Consequently, the biblical writer had the opportunity to make sure Yahweh and the angel were distinguished, but did not do so. This failure occurs in several other places in the Old Testament even more overtly. It's not really a failure. It's not a careless oversight. The wording is designed to blur the two persons. The gods of Isaac and Jacob. Genesis 26:1-5 marks Yahweh's first visible appearance to Isaac. And Isaac went to Gerar, and Yahweh appeared to him. It is a sign to Isaac that the covenant made with his father will be carried on through him. Yahweh repeats the words of the covenant to Isaac. I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father, and I will multiply your descendants like the stars of heaven. And I will give to your descendants all these lands, and all nations of the earth will be blessed through your offspring. Later, in Genesis 26, Yahweh appears to Isaac again. The baton has been passed. Isaac's son, Jacob, receives the same divine approval in a series of visual encounters with Yahweh. The first instance is the well-known story of Jacob's ladder in Genesis 28:10-22. Several details of the vision are noteworthy for continuing our discussion. Jacob is on the way to Haran, the place from which his ancestor Abraham had departed years earlier at Yahweh's command. Jacob is fleeing the wrath of his brother Esau after stealing the birthright through deception. Scholars generally agree that the ladder is probably some sort of stair-step structure that, in Jacob's dream, connected heaven and earth, perhaps a ziggurat. Jacob sees angels of God going up and down the structure, an indication of the presence of the divine council. Jacob also sees the visible Yahweh standing beside him, the familiar language for Yahweh in human form we noted with Abraham. In verse 15, Yahweh promises protection for Jacob and pledges to bring the man back to this location, the land promised to Abraham. Jacob names the place Bethel, House of God, and erects a pillar to commemorate his conversation with Yahweh. Jacob saw the visible Yahweh at Bethel. Given what we've already seen in Genesis, this isn't unusual. Things get more interesting in Genesis 31, the story of how Jacob became wealthy at the expense of his uncle Laban. Jacob's flocks had multiplied supernaturally, despite Laban's attempt to cheat him. As their relationship soured, Jacob had a dream. The wording is significant. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob. And I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift up your eyes and see, All the rams mounting the flocks are streaked, speckled, and dappled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a stone pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now get up, go out from this land, and return to the land of your birth. Genesis 31:11-13. The angel of God explicitly tells Jacob in verse 13 that he was the God of Bethel. Jacob had seen angels at Bethel and one lone deity, Yahweh, the God of Abraham. It was Yahweh who had promised protection and to whom Jacob had erected the stone pillar. This passage fuses the two figures. This fusion is helpful for parsing Jacob's subsequent divine encounters. As Jacob's life proceeds, he's in and out of trouble. Yet Yahweh is with him. After he succeeds in fleeing from his uncle Laban, Jacob learns in the course of his travels that he will soon be coming face to face with Esau, the brother from whom he had stolen his father's blessing years ago. At the time of Jacob's trickery, Esau had sought to kill him, and so now Jacob is wondering whether his brother is still holding a grudge. That meeting occurs in Genesis 33, but it's what happens to Jacob in the preceding chapter that draws our attention. In Genesis 32, we learn a lot about Jacob's state of mind and God's loyalty to him. In Genesis 32:1, God sends angels to meet him. This time, it is no dream. Nevertheless, Jacob can't set aside his anxiety. He takes steps to bribe Esau, sending extravagant gifts ahead of the caravan. He removes his children and their four mothers to the other side of the Jabbok, a small stream. Alone, that night, he has his most famous encounter with God, or maybe someone else who was also God. The story reads, "And Jacob remained alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the dawn. And when he saw that he could not prevail against him, he struck his hip socket, so that Jacob's hip socket was sprained as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for dawn is breaking.' But he answered, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' Then he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' And he said, 'Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men, and have prevailed.' And Jacob asked and said, 'Please, tell me your name.' And he said, 'Why do you ask this for my name?' And he blessed him there. Then Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, which means, 'I have seen God face to face, and my life was spared.'" Genesis 32:24-30. Genesis 32:28-29 makes it apparent that the man with whom Jacob wrestled was a divine being. The mysterious combatant himself says, "You have striven with Elohim," a term we know can be translated either God or a God. The narrative nowhere says Jacob's encounter was only a vision. This Elohim is tangible and corporeal. Hosea 12:3-4 confirms the divine identity of Jacob's opponent, but then adds two surprising details. Note the way Hosea uses parallelism to express the thought. In the womb, he, Jacob, deceived his brother. In his manhood, he struggled, Hebrew Sarah, with God, Elohim. He struggled, Hebrew Yasar, with the angel, and prevailed. He pleaded for his mercy. He met him at Bethel, and there he spoke with him. Not only does Hosea describe Jacob's Elohim opponent as an angel, but the last line of this quotation identifies this angel with Bethel. Curiously, we know from Genesis 32 that this incident did not occur at Bethel. It was at the waters of the Jabbok. Hosea's inspired commentary on the incident isn't about geography, though. He's telling us that Jacob wrestled with God himself, physically embodied, and identifies God with the angel who said he was the God of Bethel. We've seen this confusion of God with an angel before. It is deliberate. The point is not that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is a mere angel. The reverse is the case. this angel is Yahweh. We have one more passage to consider. The way it fuses Yahweh and the angel is nothing short of amazing. Genesis 48 records Jacob's deathbed words of blessing to Joseph's children. The passage references the God who had appeared to him at Bethel, who, readers know from Genesis 31:13, is called an angel. It's all set up for the thunderbolt in the section below. And it happened that after these things it was said to Joseph, "Behold, your father is ill." And he took his two sons with him, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it was told to Jacob, "Behold, your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel strengthened himself, and he sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "El Shaddai appeared to me in Luz, Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and blessed me, and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful, and make you numerous, and will make you a company of nations, and I will give this land to your offspring after you as an everlasting possession.' And Israel stretched out his right hand and put it on the head of Ephraim," now he was the younger, "and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'The God, Elohim, before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God, Elohim, who shepherded me all my life unto this day, the angel, Malach, who redeemed me from all evil, may he bless the boys.'" Genesis 48, 1-4 and 14-16. The parallel position of Elohim and Malach, angel, is unmistakable. Since the Bible very clearly teaches that God is eternal and existed before all things, and that angels are created beings, the point of this explicit parallel is not to say that God is an angel. On the other hand, it affirms that this angel is God. But the most striking feature is the verb, "may he bless." In Hebrew, the verb "bless" in this passage is not grammatically plural, which would indicate two different persons are being asked to bless the boys. Rather, it is singular, thereby telegraphing a tight fusion of the two divine beings on the part of the author. In other words, the writer had a clear opportunity to distinguish the God of Israel from the angel, but instead merges their identities. As we leave this chapter, the implications of what we've seen are staggering. The patriarchal stories create an astonishing picture for us. If there is only one God, one Yahweh, then why does the writer fuse Yahweh and the angel in some passages, but have the angel refer to God in third person in others? Why blur the distinction between Yahweh and this angel, and yet keep them distinct? What is being communicated? When the biblical text does this, it pushes us to wonder whether there are two Yahwehs, one invisible in heaven and one visible on earth. We'll see next that this is precisely the point. The God of Israel is God, but in more than one person. Chapter 18. What's in a name? We've seen some unusual things in the last two chapters. First, Yahweh called Abraham into covenant relationship with him. Then he continued that relationship with Isaac and Jacob, whose name became Israel. The descendants of Israel were Yahweh's portion of humanity. But the interactions between Yahweh and the patriarchs seem convoluted. Sometimes Yahweh came visible as the Word. At other times he came as an angel, apparently sent by Yahweh. Still other times, there was only Yahweh in human form, without any descriptive label. The language created questions about whether Israelites affirmed or denied omnipresence, and about their conception of Yahweh's identity. In this chapter, we'll be introduced to another expression for Yahweh. Its use in several passages makes it clear that the biblical writers conceived of two Yahwehs, one invisible and always present in the spiritual realm, the heavens, the other brought forth to interact with humanity on earth, most typically as a man. that there must be two is indicated by their simultaneous presence in some familiar stories. The Burning Bush. The story of the Exodus from Egypt really begins in chapter 3 of the book by that name. Moses' encounter with God at the burning bush has been etched into our minds by Sunday school teachers, ministers, and, of course, Cecil B. DeMille's epic film, The Ten Commandments. But there's something you may have never noticed about the bush. Hollywood certainly missed it. And Moses was a shepherd with the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west of the desert. And he came to the mountain of God, to Horeb. And the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and there was the bush burning with fire, but the bush was not being consumed. And Moses said, "Let me turn aside and see this great sight. Why does the bush not burn up?" And Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see. And God called to him from the midst of the bush, and he said, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "You must not come near to here. Take off your sandals from on your feet, because the place on which you are standing, it is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, because he was afraid of looking at God. Exodus 3:1-6. The text quite clearly states that the angel of Yahweh was in the bush. But when Moses turns to look at the bush, the text has Yahweh observing him and calling to him from the midst of the bush. Both the angel, the visible Yahweh in human form, and the invisible Yahweh are characters in the burning bush scene. Interestingly, verse 6 tells us that Moses was afraid to look at God. This suggests that he had discerned something other than the fire in the bush, most likely the human form of the angel. The New Testament affirms this description in Acts 7:30-35. The martyr Stephen twice tells us that there was an angel in the bush. In the conversation that ensues, Yahweh reveals his covenant name to Moses, "I am." If Yahweh is speaking to Moses, one has to wonder why the angel was needed. If Yahweh is doing the talking, why does he need a messenger? Or perhaps when the writer says Yahweh is speaking, he means the angel. Like the passages in Genesis we've already seen, Exodus 3 includes Yahweh and his angel in the same scene as distinct figures, but then creates ambiguity between them. Are there two or one? Are the two the same, but different? The reader is being prepped for something dramatic to come. He won't have long to wait. The angel, the name, the presence. We know what happens after the burning bush. Yahweh, through Moses, delivers Israel from Egypt. Moses leads the people to Sinai to meet their God, receive the law, and prepare for the journey to the promised land. There's a short conversation between God and Moses about that task that is habitually overlooked by Bible readers. In Genesis 23, God says, "Look, I am about to send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Be attentive to him and listen to his voice. Do not rebel against him, because he will not forgive your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you listen attentively to his voice and do all that I say, I will be an enemy to your enemies and a foe to your foes." Exodus 23:20-22. There's something strange about God's description to Moses that tells us that this is no ordinary angel. This angel has the authority to pardon sins or not, a status that belongs to God. More specifically, God tells Moses that the reason this angel has this authority is, "My name is in him." What does this curious phrase mean? Moses knew instantly. Anyone thinking of the burning bush account does as well. When God told Moses that his name was in this angel, he was saying that he was in this angel, his very presence or essence. The I am of the burning bush would accompany Moses and the Israelites to the promised land and fight for them. Only he could defeat the gods of the nations and the descendants of the Nephilim whom Moses and Joshua would find there. Other passages confirm that this reading is correct. This angel is Yahweh. Perhaps the easiest way to demonstrate this is to compare Old Testament passages about who it was that brought Israel out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. I am Yahweh who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be for you as God. Leviticus 11:45. You yourselves were shown this wonder in order for you to acknowledge that Yahweh is the God. There is no other God besides him. From heaven he made you hear his voice to teach you, and on the earth he showed you his great fire, and you heard his words from the midst of the fire. And because he loved your ancestors, he chose their descendants after them. And he brought you forth from Egypt with his own presence by his great strength to drive out nations greater and more numerous than you from before you, to bring you and to give to you their land as an inheritance, as it is this day. Deuteronomy 4, 35-38. Yahweh our God brought us and our ancestors from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery, and did these great signs before our eyes. He protected us along the entire way that we went, and among all the peoples through whose midst we passed. And Yahweh drove out all the people before us. Joshua 24, 17-18a. And the angel of Yahweh went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and said, I brought you up from Egypt, and I brought you to the land that I had promised to your ancestors. Judges 2:1. These passages interchange Yahweh, the angel of Yahweh, and the presence, Panim, of God, as the identity of the divine deliverer of Israel from Egypt. There weren't three different deliverers. They are all the same. One of them, the angel, takes human form. If Deuteronomy 4:37 is read in light of Exodus 23:20-23, then the presence and the angel are co-identified. This makes good sense in view of the meaning of the name which was in the angel. The name. Some readers with Jewish friends or a Jewish background know that even today the phrase the name, Hashem, is used by many Jews in the place of the divine name Yahweh. The biblical passages we've seen above show that there is biblical precedent for the practice. In other passages, the name functions as a substitute word for Yahweh. In several, the name is personified. The name is a person. Isaiah 30, 27-28 is quite striking in this regard. Look, the name of Yahweh comes from afar, burning with his anger and heaviness of cloud. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue is like a devouring fire, and his breath is like an overflowing river. It reaches up to the neck. The name is clearly cast as an entity, as Yahweh himself, in this text. In Psalm 20, 1 and 7, this is explicit. May Yahweh answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of Jacob's God protect you. Some boast in chariots, and others in horses, but we boast in the name of Yahweh our God. How is it that the psalmist would pray that the name protect anyone? Israelites wouldn't get much protection from a string of consonants, yod, hey, vav, hey. The point of the psalm is that trusting in the name means trusting in Yahweh himself. He is the name. Deuteronomy has a lot to say about the name, especially with respect to the name being the very presence of God that will reside in the tabernacle, the holy city, and eventually the temple. Deuteronomy 12 is representative. You must completely demolish all of the places where they served their gods, that is, the nations whom you are about to dispossess. You shall not worship Yahweh your God like this, but only to the place that Yahweh your God will choose from all of your tribes to place his name there as his dwelling shall you seek. And there you shall go, and then at the place that Yahweh your God will choose to let his name dwell there, there you shall bring all the things I am commanding you. Deuteronomy 12, 2, 4-5, and 11. The Commander of Yahweh's Army. Readers may have already anticipated that the angel in whom Yahweh's name, his presence, dwells, can be identified as the mysterious figure encountered by Joshua just before the wars of conquest. I would agree. Here is the passage in Joshua 5. And it happened, when Joshua was by Jericho, he looked up, and he saw a man standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, Are you with us, or with our adversaries? And he said, Neither. I have come now as the commander of Yahweh's army. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth, and he bowed down and said to him, What is my lord commanding his servant? The commander of Yahweh's army said to Joshua, Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Joshua 5:13-15. An important clue to identifying this man as the angel of Yahweh is the drawn sword in his hand. The Hebrew phrase here occurs only two other times, Numbers 22:23 and 1 Chronicles 21:16. Both explicitly name the angel of Yahweh as the one with drawn sword in hand. The connection is unmistakable on two other counts. Joshua bows to the man, an instinctive reaction to the divine presence. The commander orders Joshua, Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. The wording comes from Exodus 3:5, the burning bush passage. The angel of Yahweh was in that bush. An intriguing conversation. The angel of Exodus 23:20-23 did indeed go with Moses and Joshua to claim the promised land. In the wake of Joshua's death, however, Israel failed to complete the task. The angel of Yahweh appeared in Judges 2, bringing news no one wanted to hear. And the angel of Yahweh went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you up from Egypt. And I brought you to the land that I had promised to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, do not make a covenant with the inhabitants of this land, break down their altars. But you did not listen to my voice. Why would you do such a thing? Now I say, I will not drive them out from before you. They will become as thorns for you, and their gods will be a trap for you. And as the angel of Yahweh spoke these words to all the Israelites, the people wept bitterly. Judges 2:1-4. The angel of Yahweh's departure signaled an end to the regular presence of Yahweh with Israel. But even in the dark period of the Judges, he wouldn't stay away completely. The call of Gideon in Judges 6 includes one appearance during this period. The passage is lengthy, so the important items are emphasized. The angel of Yahweh came and sat under the oak that was at Ophrah, that belonged to Jehoash the Abiezrite. And Gideon his son was threshing wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. The angel of Yahweh appeared to him and said to him, Yahweh is with you, you mighty warrior. Gideon said to him, Excuse me, my lord, if Yahweh is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonderful deeds that our ancestors recounted to us, saying, Did not Yahweh bring us up from Egypt? But now Yahweh has forsaken us. He has given us into the palm of Midian. And Yahweh turned to him and said, Go in this your strength, and you will deliver Israel from the palm of Midian. Did I not send you? He, Gideon, said to him, Excuse me, my lord, but how will I deliver Israel? Look, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house. And Yahweh said to him, But I will be with you, and you will defeat Midian as if they are one man. And he said to him, Please, if I have found favor in your eyes, show me a sign that you are speaking with me. Please do not depart from here until I come back to you and bring out my gift and set it out before you. And he said, I will stay until you return. And Gideon went and prepared a young goat and unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. He put meat in a basket, and the broth he put in a pot, and he brought them to him under the oak, and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened cakes, and put them on this rock.
Pour the broth over it."
And he did so. And the angel of Yahweh reached out the tip of the staff that was in his hand. And he touched the meat and the unleavened cakes, and fire went up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of Yahweh went from his sight. And Gideon realized that he was the angel of Yahweh. And Gideon said, "Oh, my Lord Yahweh, for now I have seen the angel of Yahweh face to face." And Yahweh said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You will not die." And Gideon built there an altar to Yahweh, and he called it Yahweh is Peace. To this day it is still in Ophrah of the Abiezerites. Judges 6:11-24. This is a fascinating passage. In verse 11, the angel sits down under the oak tree for the conversation. He makes his visible presence known to Gideon in verse 12. There is no indication that Gideon considers his presence at all strange. Gideon's disgruntled reference to Yahweh in verse 13 makes it clear he doesn't know the man is Yahweh. The reader, however, knows that, since the narrator has Yahweh taking part in the conversation. The scene is reminiscent of the burning bush, except that both Yahwehs have speaking roles. This serves to put the two characters on the same level to the reader. That tactic is by now familiar, putting both figures on par to blur the distinction. But in the case of Judges 6, the writer also makes them clearly separate. That there are two clearly separate Yahweh figures becomes more dramatic after verse 19. Gideon asks the man, who is logically the angel of Yahweh, to stay put while Gideon makes a meal for him. The stranger agrees. When Gideon returns, he brings the meal to the tree. The narrator has the angel of God receiving it. Again, that's logical, since the angel had sat there at the beginning of the story. Now comes the shocker. The angel of Yahweh burns up the sacrifice and then leaves. But we learn in verse 23 that Yahweh is still there and speaks to Gideon after the angel's departure. Not only did the writer blur the distinction between the two figures, but he had them both in the same scene. Ramifications. The most familiar way to process what we've seen is to think about the way we talk about Jesus. Christians affirm that God is more than one person, but that each of those persons is the same in essence. We affirm that Jesus is one of those persons. He is God. But in another respect, Jesus isn't God. He is not the Father. The Father is not the Son, and the Son is not the Father. Nevertheless, they are the same in essence. This theology did not originate in the New Testament. You've now been exposed to its Old Testament roots. There are two Yahweh figures in Old Testament thinking, one invisible, the other visible and human in form. Judaism before the first century, the time of Jesus, knew this teaching. That's why ancient Jewish theology once embraced two Yahweh figures, the two powers. But once this teaching came to involve the risen Jesus of Nazareth, Judaism could no longer tolerate it. We'll see specifically how New Testament writers repurposed the two Yahweh's theology in later chapters. For now, we need to pay a visit to Sinai. Yahweh needs to lay down the law with the help of his angel and the divine counsel. Chapter 19. Who is like Yahweh? Yahweh, the Most High, the God of gods, shunned the nations. He made himself known to his chosen people, his earthly portion, in the form of a man. The revelation began with Abraham, and was repeated to Isaac and Jacob, Abraham's son and grandson. The angel who was Yahweh in human form changed Jacob's name to Israel. Jacob's sons would eventually engage in a treachery against Joseph, one of their own, that would providentially place Israel in Egypt. Many Bible readers wonder why God would have allowed, much less instructed, as in Genesis 46:3-4, Israel to go to Egypt. The question becomes even more pressing given what I've called the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, where the nations and their gods are pitted against Israel and Yahweh. The human propensity toward evil seems to explain why the Egyptians feared and then enslaved the Israelites after the death of Joseph, resorting even to murder to control the population. There's more to it than that. The Voice of Providence. The story of Yahweh's disinheritance of the nations would have been passed on orally through generations of Israelites during the bondage in Egypt. Every Israelite child would have learned about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. They would learn that their very existence was the result of a supernatural act, given that Isaac was born by supernatural intervention. They had life because of Isaac's life. But the story produced a conundrum. Why doesn't this God of gods deliver us? Oral tradition would have preserved such a promise. Yahweh had sent Joseph into Egypt to preserve Israel from famine, and had promised both Abraham and Jacob that he would bring them back to the land he had promised them. The deliverance from Egypt would resolve that issue, and that wasn't the only question God's providential acts would address. The Israelites asked, "Where is Yahweh?" in the wake of God's decision to send them into hostile territory. But Pharaoh and his people and all the nations asked a different question. Who is Yahweh? They would find out the hard way. The reason for Israel's circumstances was that it wasn't sufficient that only Israel knew Yahweh was most high among all gods, and that Israel was his portion. The other nations had to know that as well. Scripture makes it clear that Israel's deliverance had that effect. Israel was in Egypt precisely so that Yahweh could deliver them, thereby conveying this theological message. Yahweh and the gods of Egypt. Gentiles back in Canaan heard about what Yahweh had done. In Midian, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, put the impact in no uncertain terms. "Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods, even in the matter where they, the Egyptians, dealt arrogantly against the Israelites." Exodus 18:11. Yahweh's reputation among the nations was linked to Israel's exodus and transplantation in the land. This backdrop is why the Exodus event is repeatedly cast as a conflict between Yahweh and the gods. Pharaoh, as we know, was unresponsive to the command of God through Moses to let his people go. In Exodus 5:2, Pharaoh had sarcastically asked Moses, "Who is Yahweh that I should listen to his voice to release Israel?" His answer came in a series of horrible plagues. The Bible tells us the plagues were aimed at Egypt's gods, the Elohim who had been given their authority by Yahweh, and who were supposed to govern Egypt on his behalf. The idea is not that each plague neatly corresponds to an Egyptian deity, only that the powerful acts of Yahweh went beyond the power of the gods of Egypt and their divine representative son, Pharaoh. Egyptian theology linked Pharaoh and Egypt's pantheon. From the 4th dynasty onward in Egypt, Pharaoh was considered the son of the high god Re. He was, to borrow the biblical expression, Re's image on earth, the maintainer of the cosmic order established by Re and his pantheon at the creation. Pharaoh was the son of Re. Israel was explicitly called the son of Yahweh in the confrontation with Pharaoh. Yahweh and his son would defeat the high god of Egypt and his son. God against God, son against son, imager against imager. In that context, the plagues are spiritual warfare. Yahweh will undo the cosmic order, throwing the land into chaos. The final plague in particular, the death of the firstborn, was aimed at Egypt's gods. God told Moses, "And I will go through the land of Egypt during this night, and I will strike all of the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from human to animal, and I will do punishments among all the gods of Egypt. I am Yahweh. Exodus 12:12. The spiritual conflict is brought into vivid and tragic focus in this last plague. Yahweh would act directly in the form of his angel against the gods and people of Egypt. We read in Exodus 12:23, "For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer, Mashchit, to enter your houses to strike you." There is no explicit reference to the angel here. However, the word translated destroyer, Mashchit, gives us a clue as to who the destroyer was. The term Mashchit is employed in only three passages to describe divine judgment, here in Exodus 12:23, 2 Samuel 24:16, and 1 Chronicles 21:15. These last two instances describe the same event, the judgment for David's sin carried out by the angel of Yahweh. 2 Samuel 24:16-17a reads, "When the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, Yahweh regretted about the evil, and he said to the angel who brought destruction, Mashchit, among the people, Enough, now relax your hand."
Now the angel of Yahweh was at the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite.
David spoke to Yahweh when he saw the angel destroying among the people. The identification of the destroyer with the angel of the Lord is also perhaps suggested by Zechariah 12, 8-10. In the context of the eschatological Day of the Lord, we read, "On that day, Yahweh will put a shield around the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who stumbles among them on that day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, like the angel of Yahweh before them. And then on that day I will seek to destroy all the nations coming against Jerusalem. I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication, and they will look to me whom they pierced, and they shall mourn over him as one wails over an only child, and they will grieve bitterly over him as one grieves bitterly over a firstborn." Zechariah 12, 8-10. The passage clearly identifies the angel with Yahweh, who seeks to destroy all the nations coming against Jerusalem and his people. The reference to those who suffer as grieving over a firstborn is a striking allusion back to the last plague against Egypt and the death angel. That the destroyer is Yahweh's special angel should be no surprise. We've already looked ahead at his appearance to Joshua as commander of Yahweh's host. Yahweh comes in human form to be among his people and to fight for them, judging those who sought his people's enslavement and death. The visible Yahweh would later do the same to other enemies, like the Assyrians. Who is like Yahweh among the gods? On the other side of the Red Sea crossing, this earthly judgment of Egypt is clearly viewed as a victorious outcome of a cosmic conflict in the unseen world. As we've seen so often before, behind a familiar story much is missed without a grasp of the ancient cosmic worldview. Having crossed the watery chasm on dry land, Moses and the people of Israel sang the praises of the unmatchable Yahweh. Note: the Israelites crossed through the waters of the Red Sea. The biblical phrase Yam Suf, translated by most scholars as Sea of Reeds. The word red in Hebrew is Edom, which does not occur with Yam, sea. The phrasing and its translation has led to voluminous debate over the location of the crossing. To make matters more confusing, Numbers 33:8 says the Israelites went through the midst of the sea into the desert, and has the Israelites at the Red Sea, Yam Suf, days later. Scholars have offered a number of ways to reconcile the accounts, though all of them depend at some point on speculation. For our purposes, the proposal that Yam Suf describes both a real location and the primeval waters of chaos is most interesting, particularly in light of the ensuing discussion of Psalm 74. End note. This song is recorded for us in Exodus 15. Moses asks, "Who is like Yahweh among the gods, Elim?" The answer to the rhetorical question is obvious. Yahweh is incomparable. No other God is like him. As I noted earlier, if the other gods were considered fairy tales by Israelites, this statement is at best a joke, and at worst,